Morning. Welcome to our session on the topic of millennials. No one's ever heard that word before, I'm sure, in this room, certainly not in this industry. Nobody talks about it, right? So today we have three very fascinating research-based presentations. Just a little bit of ground rules before we kick them off. You're welcome to raise your hand if you have any clarification questions, if a speaker says something that you'd like them to elaborate on or something appears on a slide that you'd like clarified. Please feel free to interrupt. Other than that, please hold your general questions till the very end, till the last presenter is through, and we'll have some Q&A at the very end. And with that, I'll pass that on to Don.
Good morning. This presentation is kind of a teaser for the main event, which is the third one on segmentation. And this had its genesis a few years ago when, a very long time ago, because I am a recovering demographer. I worked, just general background. I came out of grad school with a degree in statistics and a minor in ecology, with the point being I was doing mathematical models of natural populations. And needed a job, and our state demographer's office needed somebody to do population forecasting. And I pointed out to them that actually my specialty had been predator-prey modeling, which didn't really apply to the demography of the state of Minnesota. And they said, good enough. And so I spent several years as a demographer. And came to appreciate the value of the saying that demography is destiny. And as a result, when I am now spending a lot of my time doing either public policy research or market research, I find myself immediately going back to what I learned as a demographer and saying, what can I learn about this particular problem? And see how it applies to the destiny of whatever it is I happen to be examining. And I realized that when we start looking at millennials and how the experience of the millennial generation is going to play out in terms of gambling, that there's a tremendous amount of that we can learn simply by looking at it from a demographic perspective and say, what do the demographers tell us about this generation that we can then translate into gambling? And at the same time, I've been exposed to sociologists and cultural anthropologists. What can they tell us that we can then apply to the study of gambling without that doesn't involve directly looking at gambling? And we can then apply that knowledge to our gambling studies, as you'll see later on. And the answer is quite a bit. So the millennials. Number of different names, a connected generation. We're talking about a generation that was born between 1982 and 2004. So the youngest, the oldest of them are now over 30. The youngest are 12. And we have other names for them. Gen Y was common for a long time, which is kind of a ridiculous name because it follows Gen X. Well, Gen X wasn't the letter X, it was the Roman numeral X for 10 because it was the 10th generation in American history. And now we're hearing the children of Gen X being called Gen Z. Come on, but again, we're gonna start the batteries and double A and triple A and so on. Generation Me, Generation 9/11 for the formative event, and the Peter Pan generation because in the eyes of some, they refuse to grow up. But what demography tells us is, one, they're numerous. There are a lot of them, and that makes a very, very big difference in terms of how they are perceived. They are diverse. They are delaying adulthood. And let's look at the numbers. Here you see roughly by generation, and you see that now, not by a lot, but the millennials, 18 to 34, are the most numerous generation in the United States. I think that also holds true for Canada. Doesn't quite hold true for Europe, I don't believe. But I could be wrong. I could be wrong about that. And the, for lack of a better term, Gen Z, and they will be named at some point. coming up, again, not to fold ahead, but you know, look at poor Generation X here, this kind of dip there. There was an opinion piece in the Minneapolis paper not too long ago from that was headlined, "I'm Generation X, please pay attention to me." Because they just don't get that same degree of attention that the larger baby boom generations and the millennials will get simply because of their numbers. I mentioned diversity. This is a new concept from the Census Bureau called the Diversity Index. And basically what the Diversity Index is, it's the probability that if you pick two people at random, they will be of a different racial or ethnic group from each other. And you go back to the silent generation, born before 1946, and if you pick two people at random from that generation, there would be a 63% chance that they would be of the same race or ethnicity. Only a 1 in 3 chance that they would be different. For the baby boomers, that goes up to 48. It's about a 50-50 chance of whether or not they would be the same or different. But again, when we look at the millennials, it's almost exactly the opposite of the silent generation. There's a 70% chance that you will pick two millennials at random and they will be of a different race or ethnicity. That's a tremendous change. And Gen Z, you can see it's even greater. Now, one of the consequences of that for the millennials is they don't see diversity as an issue. It's just not something that they're conscious of, that they are aware of, and sometimes if it's not present, they think, oh, this is a little odd. But they don't think in terms of diversity being in any way at all remarkable. It's the new norm. I heard a speech by a millennial marketer once who was hanging with his friends, and his dad said to him, this is when he was a kid, boy, you guys look like a miniature United Nations. And he realized, yeah, I guess we do, but I'd never thought of that before. And so what? I think there's a very different mindset around diversity. It's not something that you kind of wave a flag around. It's expected. In terms of a service that you offer, be it gambling or something else, there is the expectation that it's something that will be accessible and amenable to people of very diverse cultural backgrounds. The millennials just no longer get excited about the phrase, the first woman to, the first African American to. That's old hat to them. And the millennial reaction to the first time that a major political party is going to nominate a woman for president of the United States is, so what took so long? They don't see it in any way remarkable. Postponing adulthood, and the general figure that's put off of this is about 5 years, and that seems to be right. This is the median age of first marriage from 1890 through the present on a somewhat condensed time scale. And you can see how, you know, certainly since World War II, how that number has gone up from about roughly 22 years for men to about 29 years, and for women about the same. Particularly for women, there's been very much a change in expectations. And I think that in this case for the millennials, it's something of a response to economic conditions, but it's also very much a continuation of a long-term trend. People are getting married at a later age than they did even very recently. You see this too, average age of first-time mothers, how it has gone up in the U.S. since just from 1970, from 21 to 26. Again, there's that 5-year increase. Economic insecurity, yeah, possibly. But it's also, I think, more indicative of this longer-term trend of postponing adulthood. Remember, I mean, those of us who are baby boomers, 18 years old, your parents' attitudes towards you staying in the house was, you're gone at 18. Not at all true for the millennials. Here's data that's a couple of years old on people, the age at which people stop living with their parents or relatives. And you can see how, particularly since 1960, that has gone up. There are now, for women, if you go back to like the 1940s and 1930s, the expectation was you did not leave your parents' home until you got married. And that has not been the expectation for a while, but still, I think to some degree for economic convenience, for others because it's just a cheap date, they will continue to live with their parents much longer than those of us who are my age certainly would have. There was a poll that I think relates to this very strongly, where people were asked, at what age do you become an adult? For the baby boomers, the answer was, boomers out there, you can tell me, what age did you become an adult? 18. For no other reason, big thing of that, of course, is that was when you were draftable age. What did the millennials answer? On the average, 30. And if you're not an adult until you're 30, you don't have to act like one.
Makes sense.
Until you're 30 either. So you'll continue to live with your parents. You will delay when you get married and so on. So, in terms of, what's expected from many of them, for an entertainment experience, be it gambling again or something else, there is something of a refusal you don't quite need to take the same degree of responsibility for your actions. You don't need quite so much to behave as some previous generations did. Now, as you'll see in the final presentation this morning, there are lots and lots of exceptions to that. But as a general trend, I think it's pretty indicative. So we start looking at the culture. And what do we find? We find, I mentioned, diversity is not an issue. We also see that formative experiences, I think this is true for every generation, are different for each generation, and they are critical. One thing that's absolutely fascinating, Beloit College, and some of you have seen this, a number of years ago, a couple of professors at Beloit College started to put together a list of cultural references for the faculty so that they would understand how the incoming freshmen were different than the faculty were. And they've been putting this out now for about 20 years, and they started calling and publishing it the Beloit Mindset List. And from this year's, here are a couple of items from this year's Beloit Mindset List. They've never licked a postage stamp. There has always been Google. Email is now considered formal communication. The last century is the 20th. So if we look at the key formative experiences for the millennial generation, I think there are two. For seniors, you might say World War II and the Great Depression. For the baby boomers, something like the moon landing, Vietnam. For the millennials, the Great Recession and 9/11. And what both of those led to, I think, is this tremendous sense of insecurity being the normal. That personal security is not, they don't have the same degree of confidence in personal security that generations brought up before 9/11 did, or in economic security. In that regard, they more resemble their grandparents, whose formative experience might have been the Great Depression. And that has, I think, a lot of implications that go well beyond attitudes towards a job. Certainly as far as gambling is concerned, I think it has a tremendous amount to do with people's willingness to take risks. And that one of the things that we will see is that something that characterizes the millennial generation compared particularly to Gen X is a degree of risk averseness. And even to something as small as spending a dollar on a lottery ticket is maybe a little bit more, it's just more of a risk than their attitudes that have led them to believe that they should be taking. And some interesting implications. Bill Albert, who's the director of the National Campaign to prevent teen and unplanned pregnancy. And he said, teens are not checking their stock portfolio before they hop in the sack, but if their own family has to do more with less, it may have fostered a more cautious attitude about sex. And the teen pregnancy rate now, right now, is at a historic low. Is that a response to the economic uncertainty that the generation was brought up with? I think very, very possible. They face economic uncertainty, mentioned. They have no expectation of lifetime employment. Average student loan debt, $28,000. Now, if you're coming out of college with that $28,000, you know, to what extent are you going to go? Are you going to then say, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to go gamble? Again, that seems to be kind of, you know, potentially an unacceptable risk. But at the same time, they're the most educated generation in history. And I think if you, again, in devising services, I think that's something you need to take into account. But they also have this sense of entitlement. I mentioned the risk aversion. Now these, oh yeah, turn my page, that's right. These are quotes we got from focus groups that we've done with millennials as it pertains to gambling. I want things that are a sure bet. I feel guilty about spending my money on a long shot. What happens if you win? Are you going to just want more? There's a fear of, we've actually measured this, a fear of addiction among millennials that's greater than we seem to have for other generations. They really are afraid of something like gambling. They could get hooked. Again, not all, but it's more of a tendency than with other generations. They grew up with a sense of entitlement, and as they mentioned, they default adulthood, I think, what possibly is a result of this risk aversion. This was the generation that was given trophies for showing up. They had the helicopter parents. Those of us baby boomers who had children, yeah, we were so much more involved in our children's day-to-day activities. We had, you know, instead of, hey, kid, go out in the yard and play. No, you had the play date. Very, very different growing up experience. And the mantra of the baby boomers as parents was, we want it to be easier for our children than it was for us. And as a result, we tended to protect them from the consequence of their actions. And so if they do something like, if they have a bad experience or they lose or whatever, they're expecting someone to step forward and maybe bail them out of that. So I think there is this degree of entitlement expectations. And where that gets reflected in entertainment experiences is entertainment seems to be much more about them. There's much less of a willingness for millennials to sit in a theater and watch someone else perform. They want to be part of that experience. I had the opportunity a couple of years ago to talk to the Las Vegas police commander who was in charge of the Strip precinct. And he said, they don't want to be entertained, they want to be the entertainment. And I think where do you see that reflected? In the ubiquity of the selfie. You go to a celebrity right now, you don't ask for an autograph, you say, selfie, right? Because that way you are part of that experience. It's not just about the celebrity, it's about them and me. And likewise, as a result, I think they want it their way. McDonald's right now is in trouble. They're in trouble because, I mean, what happens if you go to McDonald's and you say, yeah, I like that hamburger, but I like it without the pickle? Well, that's the way it comes. And that's not what the millennials expect. I think this is a good thing. McDonald's is trying to adapt to this, but they're not being very successful at it because it's just not part of their culture, the corporate culture. Who's cleaning their clock? Chipotle. Where you can have the Chipotle, you can walk into Chipotle and get it any bloody way you want. And that is now the fast food destination of choice, certainly for the millennial generation. And I think by and large, because of that absolute total ability to get that food any way you want, which for those of us who grew up in the baby boom generation, or even Gen X, is just simply not part of the fast food experience. They are tech savvy, right? Wrong. They're tech dependent. And there's a difference, because to be tech dependent just means that you can't get along without it. You don't have to know anything about the way it works. Gen X was tech savvy because they were the ones who had to design the stuff and had to have a much greater deal of technical sophistication to operate something like a desktop computer than the millennials did, where everything's plug and play and relatively easy to use. live in the moment. I love this quote from a focus group we did. I'm conscious of budgeting, but I don't want to miss out on something just because of the financial side. It doesn't really matter to me right now. I can make money later. What's 10 bucks today? And that's from a 22-year-old. Now, again, I think you talk to a 27-year-old, and that attitude could be very, very different because they're that much closer to their vision of adulthood. This is the YOLO generation. You only live once. And that phrase, by the way, I am told, is now totally passé. But it's now derogatory, actually. Oh, that's so YOLO. But you notice how much of their discretionary entertainment money was spent on food and or alcohol. But they will tell you they plan for the future. They're pack animals. A few weeks ago, I was at a restaurant, and it was a Saturday night, and there were a lot of couples there, a lot of young men and women there going to prom. And we actually had several tables at this restaurant of prom groups. And what struck me is that in every single one of them, the numbers, they were not couples. The most extreme being one table where there were three guys and eight girls. That would not have happened for those of us in the baby boomer generation when you went to prom as a couple, right? They're going to prom as a pack. Very, very different. Connected, of course. Facebook, Twitter, Snapchat, etc. I don't have to say much more about that. Look at this. This is data that's now a couple of years old, about number of text messages sent. And I'm showing you Minnesota data here, which in the middle, where an average number, a millennial, 18 to 34, was sending 458 text messages a week. But look at the right, compare that to people 35 and older, 68. And there's people in there who are doing a lot to make up for me, I can tell you that too. Just much, much greater use of technology, or different technology, as opposed to the telephone, which once upon a time was new technology too. By the way, the millennials ask you, so why do you say you dial a phone? They don't have the same taboos. This is, you look at this for support for legalizing marijuana by generation. You see the same trend for same-sex marriage. This is the generation for whom condoms have always been advertised on television. For the baby boomers, and certainly for our parents, that was kind of a shocking thing when that happened. Millennials take that sort of thing for granted. I mean, you can say the same thing. The change in advertising for feminine hygiene products. Think about that. That was something that was confined to, women's magazines, which is, again, an interesting concept that I think is going away, and referred to in euphemistic terms. And now it's mainstream marketing referred to very directly. And that taboo includes gambling. You can see the steady decline in moral opposition to gambling. And this is Minnesota data, by the way. It's not, but I think you will see the same thing reflected nationally. Now, that doesn't mean they're that much more predisposed to do it. It just means that moral opposition is not really a reason for not. And even those who say they're morally opposed, it turns out they're morally opposed to some gambling. They're not morally opposed to all gambling and what they consider gambling is also a very, very different concept. And so, what that means is this is probably not a good way to do gambling prevention. This was actually a church very near my house. And fortunately, I was out of town that day, so I did not have to cope with the traffic jams that no doubt resulted from that. They're stressed. In addition to the YOLO generation, this is also the FOMO generation, fear of missing out. At 24/7 lifestyle can be really exhausting. And what we found out, and again you'll see in the study that we're presenting at the end of this, is that they very much value alone time, but they think it's somehow kind of abnormal to want that, and they're afraid to admit it. They distrust institutions. And you see that reflected in political independence, religious affiliation. And while we're at it, they distrust people. They simply, again, I think for, you know, going back to the Great Recession and the degree to which they really, you know, that was caused by some, you know, manipulation of by the big banks and Wall Street and so on, the trust of people just simply is not there. Now, those of us who are involved in the gambling industry, or maybe a state regulator, or an institution that provides treatment services for problem gamblers, guess what? You're an institution. This is not a generation that is going to respond to a message like 8 out of 10 doctors recommend. What they care about is what their friends posting on Yelp or their peers posting on Yelp said, not what the quote-unquote experts say. So that I think that requires, particularly looking at something like problem gambling treatment or any kind of other medical intervention, or even as a marketing experience, that expert testimony counts for nothing. Don't do it. They grew up with gambling. If you're a baby boomer, when you grew up, 1970, lotteries in 3 states, there was the illegal numbers game, right? Mostly inner city. Casinos in Las Vegas, and if you're young enough, Atlantic City. Horse racing, somewhat available, very available in some places, not at all available in others. And you had the neighborhood bookie, particularly if you lived in my old neighborhood. Millennials, you've got 2,000 lotteries in 28 and 38 states. So that was the norm for most of them growing up. Casinos now in 36. Horse racing is scarce. It is no longer part of the popular vocabulary. And they grew up with internet gaming, be it legal or not. Fantasy sports has, not so much the daily, but fantasy sports as a concept has pretty much always been there for them. And now you have the emergence of esports, which you'll hear more about later in this conference. So what, you know, going back 20 years, and I heard about Generation X, this is the first generation to grow up surrounded by gambling, and the prediction was, as a result, there will be this epidemic of problem gambling, and guess what? It didn't happen. So we have the millennials growing up even more surrounded by gambling. Can you expect more gambling problems? I doubt it, because that hasn't been the experience. What happens is, because it is part of the normal culture, that gambling doesn't have that same sense of the forbidden fruit about it, and I think as a result, maybe there's less of an appeal, and probably no greater tendency to develop it as a form of rebellion or forbidden fruit. This was in a focus group. We asked people, to millennials, to draw a picture. I'll take a piece of paper. On the left-hand side, draw a picture of a gambler, and on the right-hand side, draw a picture of yourself. And we got a lot of pictures that look like this. There's the gambler on the left and the millennial on, and well, you can guess which is which. You know, not necessarily pejorative, but it was something not like them. When we, at every single case, when we asked the millennial to draw a gambler, they drew someone older than themselves, without exception. So the key question here for gambling is it abandoned? Or is it just delayed? If they're growing up later, if they're not an adult till 30, are they not going to are they going to start when they hit 30 to display more of the gambling pattern of their predecessors? Or is it going to be their relative lack of interest in gambling in their 20s going to carry over into their 30s and 40s? And the answer to that is, I don't know. Ask me in 10 years. Thank you on that. And stage two, I'm on research challenges for the millennial generation. I am going to introduce from Ipsos, Paul Lauzon.
Great, thanks, Don. I hope this is working. You can hear me? Good. I'm going to be walking around a little bit because I've had a couple of cups of coffee with very little food and I'm a little bit jittery. I don't think I could stand behind the podium. This has been a very interesting challenge for the market research industry. I work for Ipsos. Ipsos is roughly the third largest market research survey-based firm in the world, and I manage a lottery and gaming research team. And one of the challenges for the industry as a whole has been how to reach millennials. And all the big companies and small companies, boutique shops, have come up with new tools and technologies, and particularly mobile technologies, to enable us to reach millennials. But when we're talking about different scales of surveys as opposed to qualitative research, we've definitely run into some problems, and I'll talk about that a little bit more. I am going to skip my slide here about characteristics of millennials. I think that won't hold a candle to what Don just showed you. He pretty much covered all of it. There are lots of traditional methodologies that we still employ that work really well with millennials. If we are doing casino research with, say, core regular casino visitors, the best methodology is still, unless you have the database from the casino operator, the best methodology for that is still intercepts right on site. Traditional methodology, fairly labor intensive, expensive, but it works really well. We still do a lot of qualitative ethnographies, but we also have digital tools like the people's phones where we can do use added sort of enhanced techniques like what we call iJournals, where people report on their phones as part of an ongoing study, things like that. So it's very quite exciting, some of these tools that we've been able to use. Before I get going, let me ask a question. How many people in the audience here are involved either directly in survey research or feeding into survey research as marketing people or products people? Just give me a sense of who's involved. Okay. And also, who I would identify here as being a millennial? Wow. Okay. So I get it. Watch what I say about millennials, because I've been doing a lot of research with millennials for a few years. And I'm really getting tired of it. I want to move on to the Generation Z. I'm from Canada, eh? So we don't say Generation Z, we say Generation Z. Who's from Canada? Anyone from Canada here? Ah, right on. So our challenge in the market research industry has really been with our more large-scale studies. They're sort of representative general population or larger-scale studies of a certain target audience. This is where we've run into some issues the last few years. Before I get into that, let me take you back through a little bit of history. So market research, when it became popular for political polling back in the 30s and 40s, was mostly door-to-door research. People would show up at your door, knock, and you'd invite them in your home, serve them tea and crumpets, and they'd do a survey with you. Somewhere around the 70s, this became the popular way of data collection on a massive scale. It basically, you know, where door-to-door in-person research had about a 40 or 50-year run, the telephone had about a 30-year run as a very popular device. Now, for you millennials, do you recognize that as a telephone, right? Okay. Yeah. And especially once the technique of what's called auto-dialing came on board sometimes in the mid to late 80s, it made RDD sampling very efficient, very quick, and very relatively low cost compared to previous techniques. Does it still work? Well, we do have some clients, political clients mostly. I myself have one lottery client that still does two ways of tracking every year using a telephone RDD sampling approach. We're trying to move them to an internet approach, but it's a hard sell. They want to spend the money, and they have some political demands on them that requires them to do it by phone for whatever reasons. However, there are some issues. If you're just using RDD telephone sampling, you're missing all of the people that do not have a standard landline in their household, which we know in the US is like, I think half the population now doesn't have a landline. Among millennials, it's even more. And if you want to include cell phone sampling as part of your sample frame, that's very expensive. In Canada, it's less expensive because we don't have the same legislation that you have in the US. We can use auto dialers in Canada to dial a cell phone sample. In the US, you can't do that. So all your cell phone sample in the US has to be manually dialed. So that makes the cost even more. Some other stats on, this is a case study from several years ago in Canada. Where we employed a dual frame sample, 60% of our sample was RDD landline, 40% was cell phone. What we found is the RDD landline got us 10% of millennials. This is, we let the sample fall out naturally. We got more millennials using the cell phone approach. Great. However, the cost is so expensive to reach these people. We just couldn't, our clients would never be able to pay for this. Furthermore, I mean, the ability, you can't show videos on the phone or standard landlines and things like that. You can't show images. There's so many drawbacks to using the telephone. As far as I'm concerned, it's really a dinosaur. It's in the past and it should stay there. However, what about internet panel research? So my team, we did our first internet study for the Florida Lottery in 2002. And at the time, I thought I was pretty blown away. We were breaking new ground. Our company had been doing internet studies for a few years, but that was our first one in the lottery industry. But at the time, I was telling my colleagues, I said, you know, if door-to-door research had about a 40 or 50-year run, telephone standard RDD sampling had a 20 to 30-year run, I felt, you know, I'm going to make a prediction. Internet panel sampling research, as we knew it then, will have maybe a 10-year run, and then we're going to have to change. Guess what? We're going to have to change it because a lot of people say traditional internet sampling approaches and internet research methodologies are very 2010. Right? Millennials need to engage almost in a social way with our survey instruments. The standard, and I'm going to show you some standard questions from standard internet surveys, they can't engage with that. They just, first of all, they don't have the right technology to engage with it, and they don't have the time or the attention span to engage with it. Research panels of any company in the US or Canada have not grown in the last 8 years. So for example, at Ipsos, we have maybe a household panel in the US of 500,000 people. It's been static for 8 years because people don't join panels, and it's expensive to recruit people to panels. So how you grow a panel is you change your rules of how many surveys you send out to people. And there was a belief for a long time that millennials weren't joining panels, but actually they are joining panels. The issue is that they're joining panels, but they're not completing surveys because we're throwing surveys at them in an old format, in an old standard that is not easily done on a mobile phone or a tablet. They want to do surveys on their own time. Think back to telephone methodology. 6:30 at night, you just sat down for dinner, phone rings, and it's a survey company. Do you want to do a survey? Sure. Yeah, that doesn't happen anymore. Refusal rates with telephone surveys are somewhere around 85%. The idea behind internet panel surveys was that people could do it on their own time. They could start a survey, leave it, come back later, and finish it. The reality is, even with internet surveys, the trend is people sit down and do the survey until it's done. I do the same thing. I travel a ton. I get surveys from hotels, from airlines, and they're 10, 15 minutes long. I sit down, I do my survey. I don't actually do half of it, walk away, come back and log in later and do it again. It doesn't work that way. But millennials, that's what they expect. They don't want to sit there for 20 minutes and do a survey. They want to do it in chunks of time that works for them. So we're at a crossroad. We've been at a crossroads for a few years in the industry, and I'm not just talking about Ipsos. I'm talking about all market research vendors, about how do we handle that? What do we do with that? So we definitely have to change. We have to allow respondents to do surveys in a different way, in a more enjoyable, entertaining way, because if we don't start to change that, in 2 or 3 years from now, doing survey work the way we've been doing is not going to work. It's going to be costly, it's going to take a lot longer, and it'll just disappear out of our vocabulary. So what I really want to talk about is making surveys what we call device agnostic. And by device agnostic, I don't mean about take a standard internet survey with massive grid questions and making it available for somebody to do on their phone. Because you try to look at one of these grids on your phone, and you're going to spend 30 seconds looking at that, and they're going to say, forget it, I'm not doing that survey. It's making that survey experience enjoyable and flowing on the phone that is actually something they will want to do. And this bottom bullet here is very important, because we have come across panel providers or sample providers who say, sure, we can host your survey on device agnostic platforms, The problem is, as I mentioned, you try to have these big, great questions on a, have respondents trying to complete these on the phone, it just doesn't work very well. And if you don't believe me, like Don threw a lot of statistics, but in terms of how millennials in particular, and not just millennials, but everyone who's got smartphone technology or tablet technology, how they're accessing web-based content or social network content, the growth of that in the last few years has been tremendous. Very few people are actually sitting at home now on their desktops or laptops accessing the web. It's basically done by phone. This is, most of this data I'm showing you is Canadian, but trust me, it's probably the same in the US or even bigger numbers in the US. So this is data on media activities done through their desktop, web-based media activity done through their desktop, smartphone, tablet, etc. This was in the last month, 6 months of 2014. This is in the first month, 6 months of 2015. On smartphone alone, we saw a 29% increase of people who said they were using their smartphone to access. And this was over, this data is a year ago now. Smartphone penetration a year ago in Canada, and it's higher, it's actually higher in the US, 73%. Among what we call trailing millennials, the younger ones, 86%, down to the boomers like myself at 62%. Pretty high still, even among boomers. The proportion of web or social media platform traffic that's being done on a smartphone by group. And of course, the boomers like myself, I'm still old school. If I'm gonna, I will surf the web on my phone, but I just don't have the patience. Many websites are still aren't optimized for mobile. So I prefer to still sit on my desktop or my laptop, and if I'm researching something, to look on the web. But among millennials, they don't care. The growth just in the past 6 months, this is again a year old, has been phenomenal, even among our boomer segment. Hours per day spent on the smartphone. I have some millennials on my team. I know they spend way more time than this per day on their smartphones. I know that. So I think this is fairly conservative. So think about this for a second. Desktops, laptops, they're not very mobile. Laptops are kind of mobile. I have what's called an ultra portable, and I, you know what, it feels like a brick when I carry that thing in my backpack from airport to airport. I just hate doing it because it's too heavy. If I could do it everything on my smartphone, I would. But here's a chart from Forrester Research, and it is very interesting. Where do people access the internet using their smartphone? So if you think about that, on a desktop or a laptop, you're basically accessing the internet from one or two physical locations. With a smartphone, you're accessing the internet from any location, anytime. So there's a huge impact for us as researchers in terms of what type of surveys we want to put out there and how we design our surveys. The whole concept of people starting a survey, doing a small section now, logging in a couple hours later or a day later, doing another section, and so on, is totally new. This is something we didn't really expect. Why is this important? If we are not reaching out in a device agnostic way to respondents, we're going to leave out a significant proportion of the population. What does that mean? It means we have all sorts of issues. Biases issues, coverage issues, feasibility, sustainability of the sample. Eventually, our research costs are going to go up if we don't make our surveys device agnostic, because it's going to be harder to get our samples. To change isn't hard. We've now gone through a few on my team. We've done a few this year. We've had a big initiative at Ipsos this year to start pushing device agnostic surveys. We've gone through it a few times with my team. It's actually easier than we thought, for the most part. There are still some things that are difficult to do device agnostic, but for the most part, it's fairly easy. Questionnaire length has to change. Can't do 45-minute questionnaires device agnostic, because people are not going to sit there on a phone for 45 minutes, even if it's in bursts over time. However, and I'll talk a bit more about that later, we have pushed the envelope on time on some studies we've done lately. The design of the survey, absolutely, that has to change. The look and feel of the survey, the questionnaire has to change. When I started my research career, I worked with Parks Canada, which in the US, the counterpart would be the US Park Service. We used to do pen and pencil surveys. And they were self-completed surveys that we'd have these drop-off box at trailheads in the mountain parks, and people would take these on their hikes and they'd complete the surveys. Imagine that questionnaire, you're sitting in the tent with a little pencil that we gave them, a little golf pencil, and you're completing a survey. That questionnaire has to be pretty simple and straightforward. It didn't have those big massive grids and skip patterns and all of that stuff. That's where we're going back to for device agnostic surveys, that level of simplicity. The wording. We got lazy. In the last 15, 20 years, we've been lazy. We've been putting these massive preambles to our questions. You know, things like, imagine blah, 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 blah. Now, give me on a rating scale of blah, 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 tell me this. You know, the people are reading three paragraphs just before the first question. It's crazy. We have to change that. That has to change, because that people aren't going to read that on a phone or even a tablet. So the most common denominator when you're thinking survey construction now is think mobile first, and then everything else stems from that. So question text, answer options, things like expandable lists. It's amazing watching millennials complete our surveys. They can do a whole survey using their thumb. It's really amazing. more visual, user-friendly, lots of animation, things like that, graphics. Really help the survey experience. Something to think about, the real estate that's available on the phone for the actual survey part is right here. So you don't have a big chunk of real estate to work with. Now, some phones are massive. Some phones look like books when people put them to their heads. So on those phones, yeah, you have more real estate, but you gotta think smallest again. This is one drawback. Open-ended questions, you really have to limit those. And to be honest, since we've been doing internet-based research, which is a self-completed approach, open-ended questions have not worked very well because they're not being prompted. Unless people have a hot burning issue that they want to tell you about, like my last survey with Starwood Hotels, I had a really burning issue. I tell you, I fill that thing with comments like you couldn't imagine. But unless people have a really hot issue they want to talk about, open-endeds have not worked for 10 years. So this is an example of a grid question I was talking about that we use and have been using now for the last decade in our internet sample surveys. And I think it goes like this. Here are some statements that could be said about the Minnesota Lottery. So, sorry, Don. But this is just an example, and this is one from a tracking survey from the Minnesota Lottery. Here's another grid question. These have worked well with our dedicated respondents for the last 10 years, but we've noticed over the last, probably from early 2000 till 2011, 2012, we start to see a lot more declines in completion rates in our surveys, and relying on the same respondents to answer surveys because the surveys were just too onerous, too big to do. And what we have to move to, and what we've moved to recently in two studies we've done from the Minnesota Lottery, is something that looks like this. Easy to do on a phone, much more enjoyable, more visually pleasing. Oops. And you can actually capture a lot of data. The segmentation study, which Todd will talk about, we captured an awful lot of data in a short survey using this approach. The other part we have to think about is the back end operation side of the thing. People who join a panel basically also enter a reward system, because nobody does surveys for free anymore. They have to be part of a reward system. And they usually have a login, or they can access the panel website. Well, they need to be able to do that from their phone as well. So even from the back-end operation, we had to change our interface to make it user-friendly for them from a mobile device as well. Other thing to think about, you know, it has to be functional, simple, but it has to work across all platforms. So you just can't design it for iPhone or Android. It has to be not just device agnostic, but platform agnostic as well. Early in about 3-4 years ago, when Ipsos really started to look at this device agnostic stuff, one of the concern was, well, is the outcome on the business decision going to be impacted or be different as a result of changing how we do things? Our research on research, time and time again, has shown that it hasn't. Yes, data comes out maybe a few percent different here and a few percent different there, but at the end of the day, the conclusions and the impact on the decisions haven't changed. So some key takeaways. We have to change to make the feasibility of our sample and accessing our panels continue to live on. If we don't change, that feasibility is going to get decreased. It affects our sample size, ability to be representative. So if we are only reaching people who don't have or don't do surveys, or if we're limiting people who don't have, who are not doing surveys because they're on mobile only, we're losing out a big chunk of the population. And this is going to get worse. I suspect in 2 years from now, most of the work we do will be device agnostic. This is pretty important, this last bullet here. Same thing in the US. So, and it took, you know, we're a big company, so we don't move as quickly as, say, a small boutique shop. So it took us a couple of years to kind of figure this out. People were joining our panel via their smartphone. We'd send them a survey, and as soon as our program would detect they're on a smartphone, we'd terminate them as a respondent. Terminate them, not soprano style, but terminate them as if they wouldn't be a respondent. So for a couple of years, our sample rates, our feasibility rates, and our completion rates were in the toilet, and we were burning through sample like crazy. So it took our operations people a while to kind of clue in, wait a minute, doesn't add up. We're onto it now. And we're actually, this is a plug for my company, we're one of the few who's actually leading in this area. Some of the other big companies now have also just woken up to this in the recent few months and are starting to make some changes in this. Some smaller companies, boutique shops, who are a bit more nimble, have been there already, no doubt. If we don't change, the big thing here is we can grow. Here's a quick way to grow a panel. So if you have a panel of 500,000 people and you want to double the size of your panel, you change your rules. You say, instead of sending them X number of surveys per month, let's double that. Boom, panel's now double, theoretically. But that means we're going to put more burden on the same respondent. And that's what we have to be careful of. That's why being device agnostic is so important. Sample quality, quantity, important to that we move in this direction. The last chart here is tied into the time. Remember I said earlier, when we designed internet surveys, the idea was that it could give people the flexibility to complete the survey over multiple chunks of time, which never took place, never happened. When we started designing device agnostic surveys, initially we had a limit of 7 minutes. Last year we grew that to 15 minutes. The surveys we just recently done for the Minnesota Lottery were 21 minutes with almost very little dropout. Phenomenal response rate. What we found, very interesting pattern, is people start the survey, they do a couple minutes, they log out, they go do something else, they come back, they do some more. And this can go on for hours. With some respondents, it spanned days. That is an unanticipated behavior. We didn't realize this was going to happen. It's changing, it's really changing the game on how we do surveys. I'll leave you with this scientifically, statistically valid flow diagram of how device agnostic surveys can work. All right, that's all I had. Thank you. I'll turn it over to Todd.
Hey, good morning, everybody. My name is Todd Mackey. I've worked for the Minnesota State Lottery now for about 26 years. And I have to say that I'm pleased to be able to kick off the third section of our presentation this morning. And I think the Minnesota State Lottery, to tell you just a little bit of history, is a fine institution. We've been doing $500 or $600 million in sales a year, contribute about $130 million to good causes in Minnesota, about half of that to the state general fund, about half of that to the environment. But we have been noticing a problem, and that's reaching millennials, right? We've been doing a fine job for the past 26 years. We really want to do a fine job for the next 26 years, and I think millennials are really going to change the way our business works. So to understand this group a whole lot better, what we're going to do in the next half an hour is give you a little background, do some objectives and methodology, because Paul's going to come back up. And then Don's going to come back up and talk about segments and highlights the results, and then we'll take some questions at the very end. So why do we want to study millennials at all? The U.S. Census Bureau reports they now outnumber baby boomers. That's just a huge, huge market, and when you think of that in terms of spending power, that's just an amazing number. That's a really important market to capture. And I think that the gambling choices they make are really going to change our market. We started with a bunch of things that we've been told about this group of folks. They always have their cell phones within reach. They spend free time at concerts and beer festivals. They're conservative. They're the Ben Franklin generation. What's that about? They don't carry cash. They only buy with debit or credit cards, and they only live for today. How many of those things are true? And overall, we found that sometimes millennials do agree on things in our survey results. They say it's important to stay in on the weekend and relax sometimes, which is a surprise to us. They're not always out at craft beer festivals. Spending time by myself helps me relax and unwind. It's important to me to have financial stability. It's important to have a secure job. It's important to have a healthy work-life balance. And I have long-term personal goals. Those are all statements that folks in this group agree with. Things that they disagree about, I enjoy spending time in large crowds more than in small groups. Only 18% of millennials agree with that statement. Celebrity endorsements influence what products I would buy. Only 13% agree. I would rather have lots of casual friends than a few close friends. Only 14% agree. I'm morally opposed to gambling. Only 22% agree with that statement. And I'm a gambler. Only 15% agree with that statement. So what do they disagree on? In our questionnaire, just about everything else. About half say I'm a homebody. About half say I live for the moment. About half say social drinking is part of my entertainment experience. About half say I'd rather do my shopping online. About half say I'd rather pay for purchases with cash. About half say I'd spend my time thinking about retirement savings. About half say I enjoy keeping up to date with technology, which is kind of a surprising thing. About half say social media is the primary way I communicate with my friends. And closer to 60% say I prefer to live in the moment. So we've got a bunch of things that are sometimes they have in common, sometimes they disagree on, and a lot of things in the middle. And why do we want to do a segmentation study? I'm going to turn that back over to Paul, and he's going to walk us through some methods there.
All right. So, as Todd alluded to, we found there's lots of things they agree on, lots of things they don't agree on, and then the quintessential type millennial that we thought we'd find, we didn't really find. We did find them in one segment, but to our surprise, they were small. So by what I mean, the stereotypical quintessential millennial is what basically everyone talks about, what you read about in magazines. To be honest, what we found is they're not all like that. Thank God. So we went into this to look for things like regional differences. How is technology, how important is that to their life? And Don mentioned, you know, the one belief that's out there is that they're tech savvy. Well, we know that that's not true. They're tech dependent. What are they doing for entertainment? What are their attitudes toward life in general? How do they consume news of information, you know, like the newspaper? I've actually finally given up paper newspapers a year ago. That was a tough move for me. Where and how do they shop? Lots of questions. So why do we want to know? Well, if you look at this guy on the left, and then you look at this guy on the right, or this lady on the right, just because they look the same and are in the same category, maybe dress the same, doesn't mean they're gonna, right, like the same things. An ad that drives this person might not impact this person, yet they look the same, they're the same, they go to Starbucks and they have the same phone. Right? I think you get the message. When we put people in an age bucket, we tend to think they're all the same, but that's not true. So, we did a three-phase study approach for the Minnesota Lottery. We did some pre-qual, and we did this, we segregated it on three groups, 18 to 24-year-olds, 25 to 29-year-olds, and I think 30 to 34-year-olds, right, in different parts of Minnesota. One of the things, I have to be honest, that did strike me pretty obvious, and we did them in sequence. So we had the younger group first, second group next. So right in sequence, the same nights, each night. So when I was listening to the first group, the dialogue around the table was, so the moderator asked a question, so what do you think of this concept? Those were the responses. Move to the next focus group, 24 to 29-year-old. What do you think of this concept? I'm not really hot on that. I don't really like it. Then you move to the 32-year-old. What do you think of this concept? I'll tell you, that doesn't fit my lifestyle at all. Like, I'm just way too busy. I have too much to do. Like, this isn't going to work for me. Just the language and their ability to communicate coherently from that one age group to the next was one of the most mind-blowing findings I had that evening, the one evening. But that is somewhat misleading. It had me thinking from the qualitative stage, okay, so I got it now. They're really three buckets. But when we went to the quantitative stage and we analyzed the data after, we found many of the attitudes and opinions transcend those age cohorts. So, my message there is don't let age classification dictate everything about millennials, because it's not necessarily true. So the next phase was the quantitative phase. We did a large sample of millennials, and then the third phase was basically, again, a post-qualitative where we recruited the segments we had identified. We interviewed, you know, in focus groups, and again, we saw them coalesce now, not just by age, because there was people in these different segments or different ages, but have very similar attitudes and beliefs. And from there, we basically spent a day poring over the data, reflecting back on the qualitative we'd seen, and came up with names for these segments. So just on the quantitative phase, for those, I'm sure many of you are familiar with segmentation. For those of you who are not, this is gonna be just a very quick, sort of easy 101 on segmentation. So we have the general population in this chart here. And our millennials would be that sub-segment of the market that we were interested in. So what we're looking for in segmentation is how do groups of people cluster together based on certain attitudinal beliefs or opinions, and what makes them different, these clusters different. That's really what segmentation algorithms do. So the idea was to, from that sub-market, identify segments that are different from each other but tightly knit together within the segment. So this is our segmentation computer. It's got a button on there that says go segment. So here's the types of things we put in the segmentation computer. So scale, and these were all scale questions, 1 to 7 point scales. And for the types of segmentation algorithms that we use, this works better. It gives us cleaner segmentation. For those of you who are more statistically minded, Just for background, the software we use at our company, Sawtooth Software, and the actual solution that came out that we ended up using for this is called Ensemble Centered Solution. And centering means we apply centering approaches to take out the scale bias of the respondents. I'm not a statistician. I'm a sociologist by training. So if you want more information on those techniques, I'll get it for you, but I won't be able to talk about it that much. So anyways, back to our sophisticated segmentation computer. So that goes into the blender. Attitudes towards life, media habits, information about the lottery and so on, participation in lottery and gambling activities, technology and their use or dependency on technology. Then we press the go segment button, out pops our segments. Now, again, for those of you who want to know a bit more about the technique, when the segment solutions come out, or before we even subject it to the segmentation algorithm, we look at our data, we usually submit it to a factor analysis. We try to identify the groups of variables that load on certain factors to try and identify dimensions of responses. We look at the standard deviation of the variable. So variables that have very little standard deviation, we don't bother including, because if there's no variance, it's not going to do anything in the segmentation. Get submitted to our segmentation. We get various solutions. The ensemble approaches, I think, runs like a minimum of 30 solutions. And it picks the optimal solution. We look at a number of different solutions. We look at the various statistics related to it. We look at discriminant analysis output and statistics there as well to help us identify the robustness of the output. And then we end up picking our solution based on that. So the segments we ended up getting here in Minnesota and from our naming session that we had last week, which was a long day. Segment naming sessions are not easy, trust me. You're sitting there with pouring over big, massive decks of data and trying to come up with names that sort of make sense for these segments. This is what we came up with. Tech-dependent homebodies. Probably of all the segments we identified, this one was the most surprising for me. I subscribe to this myth that millennials were basically hung around in packs and were always out doing stuff. Well, there is a segment that is totally not like that. They live vicariously through their devices and their digital technology at home, and they don't leave the home much. They actually self-identified as homebodies. Social trend surfers. This is the quintessential, stereotypical millennial. That definitely represented. That's exactly what I had in mind. Rational planners. These are the anal people like me. They're very rational about everything they do. They plan everything. And I was watching these young people going, oh my God, you're going to grow to be like me. And then traditional risk takers. This was another very interesting segment, more likely to play lottery games and to go to the casinos. Look more like a traditional type of gambler that we would see today. So I've talked about the various steps already, just a quick write-up on what we did here. I think I've already covered these, and I think I'm going to turn it over to Don now to actually take you through some detailed descriptions of what these segments are.
Okay. As I trip over the cord here. Thank you. We've introduced you to the four segments, and if we're stumbling over this a little bit, it's because this is very new. We have not had time really to live with this yet. Paul mentioned that our segment naming session was 6 days ago. And there's actually one part of the study, there was a second quantitative phase that we're not going to talk about because we just got the data 5 days ago and have not had a chance actually to look at it. But that goes into the details on the leisure activities and the media habits of each of these segments. Paul mentioned the social trend surfers, which was the biggest group of the four. But it's still less than one third of the millennial population. And again, these are the ones who exhibit most of the stereotypes that we commonly hear about millennials. They live for the moment, two out of three. They want to be out on the weekends. But even there, it's only 61%. So this 24/7 lifestyle, always with people, is so exaggerated. A third of them admitted to being influenced by celebrity endorsements. And I find that number incredibly high. I mean, you think about it. People say, I don't know, how much are you influenced by advertising? And of course, we all say, oh, of course not. We're not influenced. We know that we are. Celebrity endorsements, kind of the same thing. But here, if they're going, yeah, I am, they will admit it, which means the actual number is probably quite a bit higher than that. Purchase a product that they see a celebrity they like using it, about half said, oh, yeah, they admit to that, that a celebrity will have that kind of influence. Now, their definition of a celebrity might be very different. That doesn't mean who you see in People magazine, necessarily. I mean, it's, they can be, a celebrity can be somebody within an area of expertise for an activity that's really critical. My son is a video game designer, and he actually, in that field, I have seen people stop him and ask him for his autograph, which, I'm sorry, you're not going to see him in People magazine, but among that particular subculture, that's somebody who fits the definition of a celebrity. Two out of three say social media is the primary way to communicate with friends. And again, this is, I think it's kind of counter the stereotype in that even in this most social media active group, one out of three don't do that. And they use social media to follow brands. I think this is the important one. And they trust social media with personal information. Because we'll see that most millennials do use social media as a means of communication. But this is the group whom, if you are using social media as a marketing tool, for a good, for a service, this is the group you're going to be reaching that way. The others are not using social media, are not going to be predisposed to follow your brand through social media. They also are the most, these are the ones who say, I love those online ads that come up targeted to me, that this computer is smart enough to know that because I went to Amazon and looked for sunscreen yesterday, they'll come and hit me with an ad for sunscreen today. They like that. Some of the rest of us, like me, are creeped out by that. These folks like it. They want to be the first to try a new restaurant. They want to be the innovators. They want to stay close to home when they travel because they don't really care so much. Where they go is not nearly as important as who they're going with. And if we found out in the focus group, well, it's just as easy for me to get a group, and it's easier for me to get up in group and drive up to the cabin than it is to go to New York or Vegas or San Francisco, or Paris, wherever it might happen to be, because where I am doesn't matter quite so much. It's who I'm doing it with. And interesting, I think this found this interesting. They'd like to work for a well-known company too, because I think that status becomes important. These segments had a much greater gender skew than I've ever seen on a segmentation before. And I think, Paul, even that pretty much than you have seen, and you've done hundreds of these things. And this group was 61% male, and about half live in Minnesota in the Twin Cities area, which is about the state population. So they are relatively equally like to be urban and rural. What they don't do, least likely of our four segments to avoid advertising, the least likely to say gambling is wasteful, but even there, half of them are saying gambling is wasteful. Find that only about half of them say it's easy to hibernate in the winter, which in Minnesota is a pretty amazing statement to make, actually. How could you not find that he did not want to hibernate in the winter because it's bloody cold out there? And
clarification question.
Huh? No. And we are the envy of Winnipeg, but beyond that. And they're also, interestingly, this is the you only live once group, the live for the moment group. They're the least likely to feel optimistic about their future. Now, it's not that they're pessimistic about their future. That actually number was pretty small. But on the 1 to 7 scale, they were answering 4 to this. They're not thinking about their future. Now, this is in a great contrast to the second biggest group, the rational planners. And these fit some of the stereotypes of millennials, as you'll see. These are the ones, for example, they're willing to go and spend more money for locally produced food. They're willing to prefer buying from a local company. They have much more of a social conscience, as we tend to think about that, than the other three segments do. And I think, again, fitting with the stereotype, They're the ones who will not have cash with them and want to pay with their credit or particularly the debit card. They'll pay at the pump. They enjoy planning the next weekend. The first group, the social trend surfers, are spontaneous. Hey, what do you want to do tonight? Let's go. These guys have it all worked out. And they've called their friends on Wednesday and said, hey, let's do this on Saturday. They're going to be the ones who are reading the reviews. They're going to take them, if they're going to gamble, if they want to come to Vegas, they will be looking at the hotel reviews, the restaurant reviews, the club reviews, before they decide where to go. So if you are focused on those kinds of things, that providing that information prior to a visit, this is the group you're going to be reaching that way. And again, pay at the pump, it's that automation thing. They are also the most likely to see themselves as leaders, and they probably are. I was going to stereotype and say these are the people that you saw last night in Santa Monica at the Sanders rally. They want the job that contributes to society, that's very important to them. They are the best educated of the four segments. 70% have a college degree. They are urban, not surprisingly, and they pretty overwhelmingly believe that gambling is wasteful. So it's probably not the strongest market for gambling services. And they do like to disconnect from technology from time to time. That is something that is very important to them. Predominantly, heavily female. What don't they do? Eat at chain restaurants. They don't like to go talk to the clerk in the store. They don't buy new things just to see what they like. They research it first and see if it meets their needs. They know, but by the time they make their purchase, they know what it's going to be like. And again, they're not the first to buy new technology because, again, they want to do the research and see how it works first. Let somebody else worry about the bugs. Least likely to use social media to communicate with their friends. Old-fashioned calling, talking to people in person is the way that they prefer to do it. And they don't like paying in cash, which, you know, I think in the lottery world in particular, you see a lot of governments saying that you can't buy lottery tickets. You're not allowed to buy lottery tickets with credit cards or in some cases even debit cards. It's going to make it very difficult to reach these people. But they really don't see gambling as a fun part of an evening's entertainment. And they really don't see themselves as gamblers. The traditional risk takers, about a quarter of the population, their attitudes, particularly as it pertains to gambling, really correspond pretty closely to the baby boomers and Gen X. They enjoy a challenge against the odds. So the whole randomness versus skill thing doesn't matter quite so much to them. They're open very much more so than the other three segments to games of chance. They see gambling as a fun part of an evening entertainment. Sure, we're going to go out to the bar. Sure, let's buy some pull tabs. Let's play some bingo, whatever it happens to be. That resonates with them. They think of themselves as risk takers. They describe themselves as someone who lives for the moment, though I think that applies probably more to the trend surfers. And these people pay with cash, amazingly enough. Hunting and fishing, following sports teams. They like interacting with the personnel at a store or a casino, whatever it happens to be. They want to disconnect from technology on vacation. Not surprisingly, given some of those characteristics, they are overwhelmingly male, almost 3 in 4. And they are rural, very disproportionately rural. Not terribly surprising. What don't they do? They're not morally opposed to gambling. They're not likely to avoid take. They don't have that same degree of risk averseness that the other three segments do. They're the least likely to shop online, which is somewhat surprising. It's not surprising at all. And they're the least likely to pay at the pump. I mean, 3 out of 4 of them, when they buy gas, want to go into that store and pay the clerk at the counter, which is, you know, I think it's pretty remarkable even for older adults who grew up without pay at the pump, still use it. And then finally, we have the tech-dependent homebodies.
And that was kind of a word that, you know, we were reluctant to use, except when we got, particularly we got to the focus groups, they described themselves that way. They actually used that word. And then we asked on the survey, do you identify as a homebody in this group? 84% said yes. Actually, for the millennials overall, this was amazing. You think of, you know, again, as the out all the time, in action all the time group, half of them self-described as a homebody. That totally shatters stereotypes. These are the people who find it easy to hibernate in the winter. They prefer to shop online. In other words, they want to stay at home. They connect through the world through their technology. They all use technology to keep up with their friends. A lot of these people we found in the focus group said they were parents, which makes some sense. You're kind of stuck at home. You do find it harder to get out. But they would rather text than call. They're the most likely to say, the first thing I do when I get up in the morning is check my social media accounts. And even though they weren't really noticeably poorer than the other segments, they were the ones who thought that their finances were the most stressed out by their finances, the ones who the least wanted to take risks of their money. Now, income doesn't tell you anything about how much debt they're in or if they have kids, you know, what their expenses are. But it did seem like their concern about finances was disproportionate to their available resources. And this group was, again, three, in this case, almost three out of four were female. What don't they do? They hate being outdoors. They're not going to follow sports teams. In fact, if they're following sports, they'd rather watch it on TV than go to a live sporting event. They don't enjoy, these were very much introverts. They don't want to interact with a store clerk, but they're very probably the most tech dependent of the four segments. They don't think that technology is stressful, and they sure don't see themselves as someone who lives for the moment, or in particular as risk takers. So those are our four segments. And again, because this is only a few days old at this point, which we did not anticipate when we submitted for this presentation, by the way, what we're trying to do now is now come up with the implications that for what does this mean for our business, for your business, whatever it happens to be, because if you are an academic, you are working, you're interacting with millennials all the time, and certainly in whatever field you're studying, it's an important part of your study. If you're in the gambling business, it's an important part of your business. If you're involved in problem gambling and prevention treatment, you cannot be doing the same programs that were designed by baby boomers for baby boomers. You need to recognize the diversity within this generation, because the stereotypes have some use, but they sure don't apply to so many people. I mean, even reducing something as large to a generation to four groups makes me a bit uncomfortable, but it's sure a heck of a lot better than dealing with one. And Paul, do you have any comments that you'd like to make about how you have seen clients apply this sort of study?
In terms of millennial studies, I mean, Minnesota Lottery is one of the first clients that's really delved into at this level in terms of doing segmentation. We're doing some work with other clients at this level. And more we're finding these nuggets and these splinters of diversity within this segment, which I think back, that since I've been doing a lot of millennial research the last year or so, I scrutinize all sorts of marketing campaigns and advertising I see on TV or on the web or on social media now that are put out there by big companies like Coke and Procter & Gamble and so on. And you can tell the ads that are aimed at the stereotypical millennial, and it just blows my mind the amount of money they're spending chasing really a persona that I think they've created that doesn't necessarily exist across all millennials. That's fascinating, right? It's the quintessential millennial, stereotypical millennial, as we've identified here, is only a small portion of that group. So that persona, these big companies have created that persona and are throwing millions and millions of dollars in marketing and advertising at that persona that really doesn't exist on that scale. So that's one of the biggest findings over the last few months for me on millennials and what we're sharing with some of our clients.
If I can interject, I did some focus groups in tribal country recently at some casinos that were looking to broaden their appeal. How can we get younger people in the door? And the thinking going in, at least amongst the clients, was, well, they're going to say they want bars and drinking, turn this place into a girls gone wild type of atmosphere. And actually, the biggest finding, the biggest takeaway across the board were these millennial parents that no one really even thought about much at all, and kind of what they wanted, and can this be more family-friendly type of environment, which is really against what people were thinking going in, so to your point.
Because contrary to popular wisdom, at some point they do grow up.
That's right. So we're right at the end now. I think we have a couple questions.
But the question is, would Steve Wynn talk to me?
Backing up a step, do you have any sense of the millennials who play the lottery as opposed to going to casinos? Would that come out of the data at all, or would you focus exclusively on the lottery? And the second question I had was, have you done any cross tabs of just basic demographically that buy these four groups?
The first question is not yet. That requires that second survey that we really haven't had a chance to look at yet. I did have a couple of slides here, by the way, on just general attitudes about gambling, just to show you how this plays out. I forgot about these. But again, you can see that the tech-dependent homebodies are about average on, you see the traditional risk takers standing out on, I enjoy pitting myself against the odds, gambling can be a fun part of entertainment. Much more likely to do that, and the rational planners really being the opposite on that. On the negative side, you see the overwhelming agreement on gambling being wasteful from the rational planners, but again, not so much from the risk takers. And lottery participation, you see varying accordingly, that for a lottery market, the risk taker, traditional risk takers, are the ones who are buying the lottery products as we now know them, in particular, scratch tickets. So is that, we have not yet looked at the casinos. The second part of your, I'm sorry, refresh my memory on the second part of that?
Demographic.
Yes, we did. And then we found out that there was the urban-rural split that I pointed out, there was a gender split that we pointed out. Education, to the extent that the rational planners were much more educated than the other groups, the other three groups weren't terribly different there. Income, no, and that really surprised me. I expected to see much more of an income breakout, and there really wasn't.
Yeah, the first phase, that qualitative, was really aimed at trying to understand the millennial segment, different segments, or what we thought were different by the three age buckets, and that's where we generated a lot of our statements. I mean, I've done, I don't know, over 100 lottery gaming segmentation studies in my career, and we have some standard type of input questions that we use for the types of segmentation we've done in the past. This was something different, and we needed to generate a bunch of new statements, and we just did that through qualitative process to generate a lot of these new statements.
We asked some very general questions like, describe a typical day for you, describe to us how you use technology, and based on those responses collected over several nights in several different parts of the state, we then boil it down. We had, about 240 or something like that?
Right. We initially had 240 statements that we were going to put in the questionnaire, and I think we cut it back to just under 100, maybe 80.
It was more than that, but yeah.
It's just, at the end of the day, segmentation algorithms don't do well with 160 statements. There's just too much.
I think we have another question.
Minneapolis North.
So, interesting here, the segmentation. So, I have two millennial daughters, both very different. One would be 10 and one would be
It would have been really interesting to be able to ask these same questions of older adults, but it would have been, the cost of that would have been prohibitive. Yeah. And I wish we could have done it, we just couldn't.
But that's a good point, and that's the comment I mentioned. There's parts of me that identify with the rational planner, and there's parts of me that identify with the traditional risk taker. No part of me identifies with the social trendsetters at all. And yeah, maybe in the wintertime, parts of me identify with the homebody, but. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
In your research, it seems that you looked at individuals. Is there any way to go back and look at research and look at the impact of couples?
Sounds like a good
sitcom. Well, first of all, remember for the proportion of millennials who are actually married is quite a bit small. I understand that, but yeah, it's still going to be quite a bit smaller. I think that would be interesting. Methodologically, that would be extremely difficult to do because you'd have to get through survey every millennial member of that particular household, but it would be interesting.
Now, the other thing is, do you have any trends across the way from children across these categories?
You mean over time?
Well, no, people fill out your survey who have children right now.
We didn't ask that, and we could have. That's something we very easily could have. And in retrospect, that was one of the things that kind of came to us when we were doing this final round of focus groups with the tech-dependent homebodies, and so many of them we kept hearing, oh yeah, well, I'm a parent in that group. We didn't hear, that doesn't mean the people in the other groups weren't, we didn't know that, but yeah, in retrospect, that's when we wish we would have asked.
Yeah, because we're sort of breaking new ground in terms of a device-agnostic survey, and we knew we were pushing the time limit boundaries, so we had to make some cuts on what we wanted to include in the survey, and fortunately, some of those classification variables we...
And you could always do it. You could always do it better the second time around, but it's an expensive do-over. Not in this study, and actually, the fear of addiction came from an earlier study we had done. So we couldn't go back and link the two to see the addiction fear as privacy. But particularly for the social trend service, privacy was no concern whatsoever. It was actually astounding the amount of information that they are perfectly comfortable giving out because that's their expectation. I think even it was probably the rational planners who were the most privacy sensitive, and even there, I think compared to what you would get in a group of older adults, it's much less of a concern for them.
Well, let's be the last question.
Well, you had a good answer to that.
That was the pre-phase of the study where we did the qualitative by those three age buckets, there were some obvious differences, and the one I was poking fun at was their ability to communicate and articulate anything in a focus group setting was very different. And there was some differences, and yes, I think some of our segments do skew in age category a little bit, but not by much, which is a finding in itself in that some of these attitudes just cross these age boundaries.
What we thought was a difference in age groups turned out to be a difference in ability to articulate.
Great. Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. You're welcome to come up and speak individually to the panelists. I'd like to thank you very much. This was very informative. Thank you for attending.